As was mentioned earlier, the title of our lesson for this evening is Maintaining Purity. And it's that word that I want us to keep in mind, the idea of purity and everything that it means of being right, of being wholesome, and more or less it's a word that we can define by its opposite, of not being defiled, not being something that is dirty or ordinary, something that is set apart. As everything we read in the Scriptures, as those who would wear the name of Christ, those who are the children of God, that we are to be. That we are to be kind, we are to be compassionate, we are to be honest, we are to be hardworking. The word pure falls in that list as well. That is something that should be said of us, should be part of our reputation, like we talked about not too long ago. But the main thoughts I want to put across in this lesson is found in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and then in 2 Timothy chapter 2. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7, we're going to be turning back to this passage later on in the lesson. It says there in the first two verses, as the Apostle Paul is writing, inspired by the Spirit to the church there in Corinth, he says, "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman. But because of the temptation to commit sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman her own husband." And we'll talk more at length about what Paul is saying there again later on in the lesson. But with the same thought in mind, looking over in 2 Timothy chapter 2, as Paul is writing to Timothy here, he tells him to flee youthful lusts and pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace, along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. And in that verse, he's telling him a number of things. He's telling him not only what to flee, what to run away from, but what to pursue, what to actively make a part of his life, as we were talking about this morning, what to seek. And he tells him to stay away from this and to have more of this in your life along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. The thought there being, if you call on the Lord and if your heart is pure, then this is what you're going to be doing. This is what your life is going to be made up of. But it's this thought of purity. And as we discuss this evening, like I said, we want to keep that word first and foremost. We discuss it in a number of ways. We talk about purity of thought, purity of mind, purity of body. But certainly as we discuss this, the idea of sexual purity, of what we do with our bodies, the way in which we conduct ourselves, is one that must come up. So many of the Scriptures we find that talk about this, of remaining pure, remaining the way God has intended, have to do with that sexual relationship, because as we'll see as we go through the lesson tonight, there's a very clear way that God has designed, that He has intended, and then there is everything that the world has decided it wants to do. Everything that society and culture, as much as they change, as much as their message changes, says is all right and just fine, and clearly the two do not agree. But this idea of maintaining our purity comes from the notion that we, of course, all at one time were pure, and at a certain point are pure, and we want to stay that way because that's the way God wants us to stay. So how do we keep that state? How do we keep ourselves from becoming unstained? There's all the various ways we could talk about it, the ways it's pointed out in the Scriptures. But we want to begin the lesson for tonight with the basic notion of what so many times starts all of this off, of the ways in which we become, I guess we should say, less pure, if there were such a notion. Everything we read in the Scriptures tells us there is no such thing. You either are pure or you have become impure. But the very first thing is the idea of looking. And I don't mean just a glance here, or we happen to be looking in a certain direction, something flashes into our field of vision. The notion, what we're talking about here, is the idea of putting our eyes upon something and letting them stay there, letting our vision linger, just like David, as he was walking upon the roof of his house, happened to see this beautiful woman bathing. And if the story had ended there, that he happened to see her, that might be a better story. But we know what happened. He let his eyes fall upon her. He let his eyes gaze upon her. And the lust took root from there. And we see, of course, where it led. And that's what we look at back in the book of Proverbs. Back in Proverbs chapter 6. In Proverbs chapter 6, starting with the 23rd verse. It says, "For the commandment is a lamp and a teaching, and the teaching a light, and the reproofs of discipline are the way of life, to preserve you from the evil woman, from the smooth tongue of the adulteress. Do not desire her beauty in your heart, and do not let her capture you with her eyelashes. For the price of a prostitute is only a loaf of bread, but a married woman hunts down a precious life." And there's so many people who would read this passage and passages like it and write them off as being one-sided or outdated or sexist. That's putting all the blame on the woman. It's saying that she's this evil woman. That's not really reading what it says. That's reading into it things that aren't there. This is a warning to the man that you don't get caught up in this. Know that this is a temptation. Know that your vision is a very important thing. We are very visual creatures, and it can lead you to places that you do not want to go. But that's how it starts. So often, when people are caught in illicit relationships, you read about it in the news, how does it start? People don't just meet and then it all happens one day. No. It's when they spend time around one another, they see one another, feelings are generated, and then the illicit texts begin, or emails, or whatever it is, it grows from there. That's how it starts. And again, the notion of just anything we happen to see, a lot of it might not be our fault. We're walking down the street, we see something. The way it's been pointed out to me is in our minds, you think of it as a tree. A lot of birds can fly by or fly through, but it's the ones that we allow to land, take root there. The ones we allow to nest, that we linger upon, we allow our looking to turn into thoughts. And the worst thing that we do, the biggest disservice that we do for ourselves, is so many times we make the assumption, well, it's not going to bother me. I can be there, I can go to the beach, or I can go to this place where I know people are going to be engaged in these acts, I can watch these movies, I can watch all these things, it's not going to affect me. We say that lust is not an issue, it's not a problem for us. First of all, on what grounds do you make that assumption? What proof can you give me to show that this isn't going to affect you in any way? Fact is, we never have any. We don't have a leg to stand on with that kind of argument. And secondly, even if, for the sake of argument, even if that were somehow true, why would you want to put yourself in that kind of situation? Why would you invite these things that you know, even if you can maintain your purity, why would you choose to surround yourself with things that are less than pure? We'll use that same phrasing once more. But when we talk about the idea of it starts so many times with just a look, just a glance, it grows into something more. Again, the idea here is, what is the thought behind it? Do we allow our eyes to linger? Do we allow that gaze to continue? And when we're looking, what are we thinking about? And of course, we think about this, we have to consider the words of Jesus over in Matthew chapter 5. In Matthew chapter 5, beginning with verse 27, he says, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lustful intent has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. For it is better that you lose one of your members than that your whole body go into hell. And the way he puts it right there, so clearly, so succinctly, with lustful intent. And what Jesus was doing here is what he was doing throughout the entire Sermon on the Mount, throughout so much of his teachings, is he's bringing back the Israelites, trying to, back to where they need to be, back to the principle of the law. They'd become so legalistic with everything the Pharisees were teaching and everything that was going on, they just assumed that as long as they checked off a list that they were keeping the law, that meant that they were doing what is right. So you could look at a woman, you could lust after her, you could do everything but the deed itself, and you'd be just fine. And Jesus is here to tell them, you're not getting what God's law is about. It's about purity. It's about staying away from that entirely. He says, you might as well have done it if you look on her with that kind of intent, because that's where it leads. And again, to fool ourselves into thinking otherwise, we're doing ourselves a disservice. We're creating an excuse for something that Jesus said is inexcusable. It should not be a part of our lives. And to that end, we want to look back in Job. The Old Testament book of Job, chapter 31. What he said about his life, the decision that he had made. In Job, the 31st chapter, in the first verse, as he is speaking here, he says, I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? We talked at length on Wednesday. We're studying back in Exodus about the Israelites on Mount Sinai there, about what a covenant is. It is a commitment. It is a relationship. It is a contract. It is something to be taken seriously and personally. And Job says here he has made a covenant with his eyes. It was resolved. He's not going to gaze at these young girls. He's not going to gaze at these women. Because he understood it was important that he keep himself pure. He understood it was not right for him to do so. He knew what God's law was. He knew what his limitations were. It didn't matter if it looked good. It didn't matter if he felt like it. The decision was made because it was a priority for him. And of course, Job goes down in the history books as an upright man, one that God called out by name. Have you considered my servant Job? He had made that covenant with his eyes because he understood it starts there. It's not that he said, well, I'm not going to touch, I'm not going to do anything, I would never act upon it. No. He says, how can I gaze at them? Knowing the thoughts that it would inspire, knowing the lust that would be there, which is the exact thing that will take away our purity, the exact thing that will defile us before God. Now, if you remember before, as we were opening up the lesson, we looked over in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. And I said we'd go back to that passage, and I want to do that now because we know when it comes to the idea of individuals and their purity, it's not related, or it's not limited just to purity of mind, purity of thought. It's not just looking. It would be bad enough if that's all it were, but we know it doesn't end there. That's just the beginning. It leads to touching. And it's that word that I want to spend a minute just kind of talking about. Because when I read earlier in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, in the English Standard Translation, what it says there is that Paul wrote saying it is not good for a man to have sexual relations with a woman. And maybe when we read that, that's kind of cut and dry. Puts it very, very plainly, very simply. And why those specific words were chosen, I can't tell you. I know that the English Standard is purported to be one of the more literal translations, and so perhaps that's literally what the word, as they saw it there, came out to be. But depending on your translation that you have, it might word it a little bit differently. And I know in the Old King James, it says that he tells them it is not good for a man to touch a woman. Now, when we take the passage and we take the verse in context, there's no question here. We understood what he meant. It's very clear. He's talking about that illicit contact. He's talking about things that are unlawful. But if we were to strip that away for a second, just take away the context that we very clearly know from everything else we can see what Paul is talking about. If you were to put those two words, those two phrases, in front of anyone else in the world and ask them, is touching the same as sexual relations, what would their answer be? In our society, in our time, maybe it's the English language, I don't know. But those two phrases have come to mean very different things. Because we don't define so much touching as sexual. But why is that? Do we ever stop to consider why is one thing considered so taboo, so intimate, and the other is not? Again, maybe it's a language barrier. Maybe it's a problem with our words and semantics. Maybe it's a cultural thing. Things that would be considered sexual in this country are not considered sexual in others. I can't tell you. But I want to look back. As I said, we continue to look over in Proverbs chapter 6. Picking up from where we left off there. In Proverbs chapter 6, after he had talked about not to get caught, not to let her capture you with her eyelashes, do not desire her beauty, the idea of looking and gazing upon. In verse 27, it says here, can a man carry fire next to his chest and his clothes not be burned? Or can one walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched? So is he who goes in to his neighbor's wife. None who touches her will go unpunished. And what's interesting here is it just uses that very simple wording again, touch. He who touches her shall not go unpunished. Now, are we to read this verse and think that I could never shake hands with someone else's wife? No. Because we're not stupid. We know what this verse means. We know what it means by touching. So when we read 1 Corinthians 7, and it says that Paul tells them it is not good for a man to touch one, we know exactly what it's talking about. Yet in our lives, in our minds, we define something as sexual only when it involves certain parts of the body. Or in certain places or at certain times, and as long as you keep away from this, this, and this, so very similar to what the Israelites, what the Jews were doing, making sure we check off so many things on a list, then you'll be just fine. That seems to be the thought process. But the idea that we need to, again, revisit, and I want to, just as we went back to Proverbs chapter 6, go back to 1 Corinthians, this time in the 6th chapter, is the notion that we are better than that. Why should we accept these things as all right? That there is no problem with various kinds of touching. Well, it's what everybody does. It's what's expected. There's nothing wrong with it because it's not taking place in a bedroom or it's not taking place in the back of a car or whatever excuse we might come up with. Why do we pretend like there's nothing wrong here? That this is something that we can do and maintain our innocence or our purity? We are better than that. Over in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, looking at what it says there in verses 12 through 20, if you bear with me, it says, all things are lawful for me, but not all things are helpful. All things are lawful for me, but I will not be enslaved by anything. Food is meant for the stomach, and the stomach for food, and God will destroy both one and the other. The body is not meant for sexual immorality, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. And God raised the Lord and will also raise us up by His power. Do you not know that your bodies are members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them members of a prostitute? Never. Or do you not know that he who is joined to a prostitute becomes one body with her? For, as it is written, the two will become one flesh. But he who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with Him. Flee. There's that word again. We saw it over in 2 Timothy. Flee from sexual immorality. Every other sin a person commits is outside the body. But the sexually immoral person sins against his own body. Or do you not know that your body is a temple of the Holy Spirit within you, whom you have from God? You are not your own, for you were bought with a price, so glorify God in your body. And what's the underlying thought that we see here? What is the notion that is brought up again and again and again? It's, you're better than this. He says you are bought with a price. You are the temple of the Spirit of God. Hold yourself up to a higher standard. Don't settle for these things. Don't feel like you have to do this just because it's relevant, just because it's what everyone else is doing, just because it's the cultural thing to do. You are better than that. You're not meant for that. He says very specifically, the body is not meant for sexual immorality. God has a plan for us in our lives. There are things that we are meant to do. So often we reference Ecclesiastes, fear God and keep His commandments. The whole purpose we're put here on earth. There are things we are meant to do, and in that same vein, there are things that we are not meant to do. And we are not meant to defile ourselves with sexual immorality, fornication, all the various terms we can think of to come up with that. And by the by, as we bring out this next point, the term that we see here, translated in the English Standard as sexual immorality, translated in so many other translations as fornication, is the same word that we see over in the next chapter, as we already read in 1 Corinthians 7. The reason why he gives for them not to get involved in these things, but why it's good for each husband to have his own wife and wife to have her own husband, because of the temptation to commit fornication, sexual immorality. The Greek word there, and I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciation here, is porneia, which of course doesn't take much imagination to understand. It's the root of the words we have, pornography, pornographic. But we need to understand something a little bit more about this. It's derived from porneo, which is to sell off, having a lot to do with the idea of prostitution. So the idea here is that we are selling off, we are surrendering when we engage in any fornication, any sexual immorality, which is anything outside of what God has authorized. We are selling off our sexual purity. We're surrendering. We're giving it up. Saying, if not with our words and with our actions, it's not worth that much to us. Saying that what God deems as important, we don't care about. We're not concerned with that. And it doesn't matter if it's in a motel room somewhere, if it's on a dance floor, it doesn't matter how it happens. Anything that would compromise that is selling off that sexual purity. Giving away something we should not be giving away. We have no right to give away because it's not something we are meant to do. It's not what God expects from us. It's not what He wants for us. But anything that would inspire that lust, that sensuality, that lasciviousness. Again, there's a dictionary full of words we could use that all mean the same thing. I don't care if it's looking, I don't care if it's touching, I don't care if it's beyond that. If it's anything that would inspire those lustful thoughts, those lustful intents, guess what? It's compromising. It is selling off our sexual purity. Something we are told in the Scriptures very plainly to hold dear, to hold fast to that, to not give up. Like we just read in 1 Corinthians 6, we are better than that. And God expects better of us than that. So of all this talk of what we cannot be doing, what we should not be doing, we think about maintaining that purity. what God has intended, what we are meant for. We have to understand when it comes to the subject matter of sensuality, of those desires, we understand God is the one who designed us this way. God gives us instincts, He gives us desires, and we know with the Lord, He doesn't do anything arbitrarily. He gives us those desires for a reason. And along with that, He gives us very clear instruction as to where they belong. Continuing back with where we left off, there in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Starting with verse 3, it says, "The husband should give to his wife her conjugal rights, and likewise the wife to her husband. For the wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. Likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except perhaps by agreement, for a limited time, that you may devote yourselves to prayer. But then come together again, so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control." And turning over to Hebrews chapter 13, there with verse 4, it says, "Let marriage be held in honor among all, and let the marriage bed be undefiled, for God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous." That relationship, and we don't have time tonight to go into everything that the marriage relationship involves, because it is a very deep, very complex relationship and covenant. But one of the things that it involves is this sexual relationship. That is where God intends for this to take place. That is what He has designed. That is what He has in mind. The Hebrews writer says, it's not to be this dirty little secret that we never bring up. No. Let marriage be held in honor. That is a good thing. That is a wonderful thing. That's exactly what God wants. Let marriage be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed be undefiled. What is that telling us? Beyond the fact that this is how we are to view marriage. It tells us that when those feelings, when those looks, when those touches take place in a marriage, it's undefiled. When a husband and wife come together in such a way, they maintain their purity. Because that's exactly what God has intended. But you see how He ends the verse. That God will judge the sexually immoral and adulterous. Those who would try to have that relationship, those who would try to have all of these things, inspire those thoughts, inspire those feelings outside of the relationship of marriage. Go beyond what God has told us, what God has authorized, He's going to judge. Because they're abusing what He gives us. And quite frankly, from what we read back in 1 Corinthians 6, they're abusing themselves. It says that every other sin a person commits is outside the body. But when we are involved in fornication, we sin against our own body. We are, quite literally, as we looked at the definition earlier, we're selling ourselves short. And again, we need to stop and consider, not to just go by what society tells us, what the culture at the time deems as something that is appropriate or inappropriate. Those things change all the time. You look at the movie ratings and what's allowed on TV, things of that nature. What is deemed sexual or innocent, don't settle for their definition. And don't just go by their word for it. Really stop and consider. Whether it's the idea of looking, the places we find ourselves, the things that we're observing, whether it's a touch, and that includes dancing. The dances that individuals are involved in, again, when they're not married to one another, when they have no right to inspire those kinds of thoughts or feelings, are those things promoting this sensuality, this lasciviousness? Over in 1 Peter chapter 4. 1 Peter, starting with the fourth chapter, starting with the first verse. He says, "Since, therefore, Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. For whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live for the rest of the time in the flesh, no longer for human lusts, but for the will of God. For the time that is past suffices for doing what the Gentiles want to do, living in sensuality, lusts, drunkenness, orgies, drinking parties, and lawless idolatry. With respect to this, they are surprised when you do not join them in the same flood of debauchery, and they malign you." And what this passage illustrates, especially that last verse, is that the reaction that the world has to someone who would maintain their integrity, someone who would have their purity as a priority, they don't understand it. They, at the very least, raise an eyebrow at it, but most of the time, they criticize it. "Why aren't you? It's homecoming. Isn't that important to you?" And of course, they do this because, as we understand from the Scriptures, light exposes the darkness. And when they see someone who chooses to hold themselves to a higher standard, to not settle for that, to not sell off and surrender that purity, they take a look at themselves and they see what they're selling themselves for. And it doesn't make them look good or feel good. So when we hold ourselves to this higher standard and we keep these things in their place, when someone says they're going to wait until marriage because they respect that, because they follow God's word, it's seen as ridiculous, outdated, old-fashioned, prudish, all the different words people can come up with. But the idea of maintaining one's purity, seeing that this is what God has intended for us, and if it's not there, then it should not be anywhere, that's something we need to keep in mind. And from what we see of the definition of the Greek term that is translated as fornication, that's exactly what it is. It is a selling off. It is a surrendering of what God tells us we have no right to do so. Sexual relations, that touching, that looking, all of that is intended and is a wonderful thing in the marriage relationship. But outside of it, it shouldn't be. Not in God's opinion. The opinion of man, of course, disagrees. And the man's opinion will always be changing. But what do we go by? And what do we take as the final answer? With that, the lesson is yours for this evening.